Okay, I'm here today with my guest. I'm not even going to say her name yet because she does such wonderful things for our community that if I tell you who she is and what she does, that's all you're going to focus on. But today, we're here to talk about her story. Hi, my name is Don Anderson, and this is Missing Pieces, MPE Life. This is Season 4, Episode 3, Mystery Guest. Before we get to the episode, I just want to ask you guys, do you guys know about the summit? I'm talking about the summit for MPEs, adoptees, and donor-conceived people. It's called Untangling Our Roots. It's put on by Right to Know and NAAP, which is NAAP, National Association for Adoptees and Parents. Untangling Our Roots is a conference for people like us. You know, it's kind of like a convention, sort of. So mark your calendars, April 25th through 28th in Denver, 2024. You can register now. And guess what? Three of your favorite podcasters are going to be doing a special panel. On Friday, the 26th of April, Lily Wood, the OG of podcasters from MPE Stories, and Eve Sturgis from Everything Is Relative, are joining me as their moderator, and we're going to make a couple episodes for their podcast. It's live and in person at the summit, and you can be there to participate, to watch, whatever you see fit. And in addition, I might be just walking around with a microphone, making my own episode. So register now. Don't wait. Go to untanglingourroots.org. Untanglingourroots.org. You can register today. And I checked, plane tickets are so friggin' cheap right now because it's so far in advance. So let's all go to the summit. Speaking of Lily and Eve, you know, they're my bros. We have a group chat going, the three of us, and I reached out to them not too long ago and asked them, do you guys find it weird that you have these really intimate conversations with people? Like, usually one or both of you cry, and then you never talk to them again? And they were like, oh my God, absolutely. So, all of you people that have been on their shows, been on my show, reach out and say hi. We miss you guys. And a special shout out to Lori Canlan, who is a fan of the show and wanted to show her appreciation. She sent me a gift certificate for Jenny's Ice Cream. Thank you, Lori. That was super sweet of you. No pun intended. And if you need to get a hold of me, not just to send me gift certificates, but anything, email me at Don, N as in Nancy, P-E, at iCloud.com. That's Don, N-P-E, at iCloud.com. Or you can reach out to me on Instagram at NPE_life_podcast. Now, back to the show. Without any further ado, let's hear your story.
I never really felt like I fit in anywhere. My entire life, I think, I spent from a very young age wishing I belonged to a different family. Wishing I had that sort of Norman Rockwell family. There's that great painting he did of Thanksgiving with this huge table. And I always wanted a family with lots of people. I was raised without a father. And so I was just mom and I. And I always wanted, you know, a mom and dad and some siblings. I just thought that would be amazing. And I think looking back, I was just looking at pictures over the weekend, and I have a cousin on my mom's side, a maternal first cousin. I am 13 days older, and I never let her forget that. But we were always called salt and pepper. I was the dark one. She was the light one. She was blonde haired, blue eyes. And I have brown eyes, and I used to have black hair. I went gray very young. But that contrast between us was always highlighted by the family. I would never say my mom's family was racist or anything like that, but it's definitely your typical suburban, middle-class, blue-collar worker, European descent family.
So at that time, like when there was salt and pepper and all that, like, did you know who your dad was?
My mom married very young. She was 18 when she got married, and she met this man at a drug rehab center in Seattle. I'm from Seattle. And you know, she was just doing your typical teenage things, maybe a little bit more edgy, but it really scared her parents. And my mom's family is a whole nother story, which I'll probably get into a little bit later because I think it impacts who I am and why and how it shaped me as a person. But anyway,
what year was this in the rehab?
1973. She got married on Valentine's Day, which I find very funny because my mom is not a nostalgic romantic person, and she wore pink, which I've never seen her wear in my entire life. So I look at the pictures of her on her wedding day and wonder who that person is. but there's her and my dad. He's African American, not light skinned, and they were in love and they got married and got an apartment and tried to build a life together, but he relapsed back into heroin. Gosh, I think within 3 months, 2 months of their marriage, like I said, Valentine's Day was when they got married. And I believe I was conceived in April, maybe early May. He came back and got his stuff in June after he relapsed. He moved to Alaska with another woman. He did invite her to go along too, but she didn't want to do that. So
that was nice of him.
Yeah. Anyway, so he left for Alaska.
Did he know she was pregnant? Sorry.
No, he didn't know she was pregnant. Not that I think that would have mattered. When he was in high school, still somewhat clean, not really into heroin yet, he actually got a woman pregnant and did the right thing and married her. And they had a son together, and then he got into drugs and they got a divorce. He also got another woman pregnant after that before my mother, and she had a child. He did not marry her. She did get married, and her story is also kind of interesting as well. So by the time my mom came along, I don't think he would have cared if she was pregnant or not. He once told me, he said, "Anybody who said the kid was mine?" I said, "Sure, why not?" And when I had my own children, I would have him watch mine. And he'd never changed a diaper before. And he thought he had six kids. So I thought, wow, you made it through six children and never changed a diaper. And what's really funny is I left him with my son. And when I got home, I just about died of laughter when I went to change his diaper because my dad had put the pamper on backwards. And I was just trying to figure out how the heck he managed to get the straps on the wrong side of my baby. anyway, so he left and it was just mom and I, and we would go hang out with her family. Actually, I will bring up her family a little bit more because I think it's relevant at this point in the story. When I was three, my grandparents left. My mom's parents had built a 54-foot sailboat by hand and went to follow their dreams, and they sailed off to Tahiti. They had asked my mom and my mom's sister to go with them, but they had both just had children, Salt and Pepper, and decided that it wouldn't be a good time to bring a baby on a boat when we were so young and such a long trip. They were going to be gone for at least a year. But when they got back, they were going to take my mom and I and perhaps my aunt and her child to a trip to Europe for a number of years. So that was the plan. They left when I was three years old. They left when I was 3 years old. And they left with their son and daughter, their daughter's best friend. And while they were gone, they did make it to Tahiti. But as they were traveling around, we got word that they were murdered. And
oh my God.
It was an international incident because it happened in the high seas. And there was just those five people on board the boat. Wild stories came out, pirates, you know, all sorts of aliens. It's an unsolved case still today, and it certainly impacted the trajectory of my life and my mother's because it was such an international incident. It was in the news. I grew up with the FBI around my house. And that happened when I was 4 years old. It was just my mom and I. She didn't have her parents to help out. And for all intents and purposes, she says I was a good kid, but still she needed time and space on her own. And so,
and you didn't get to go to Europe. That's what I'm getting out of the story.
I know. What a different way my life would have ended up. So when I was seven, she said to me, I'm going to go visit my friend in San Francisco for a week, and you're going to go stay with your grandparents. And I was like, what grandparents? Now, I do have pictures of me as a baby with Kenny, my dad, and his parents. Pictures of me with his parents, not with my dad, as a baby. But I don't remember that. So I was surprised when I was seven and she said, you're going to go stay with your grandparents. So yes, I knew I was half black. I knew I had a black dad. I didn't know what that meant at all when I was seven. I had never, in my known memory, been around anybody who was black, in a very sheltered in the suburbs, but we were extremely poor. My mom and I were extremely poor. When my grandparents were murdered, we were living in low-income housing. We went to the food bank. It was...
Ate government cheese.
Government cheese, yeah. I hate government cheese.
I like
the loaf of... You liked it? I don't eat Velveeta to this day because of it. It's like that... And they give you like a brick that's like, yeah. You know... I thought it was 2 feet long as a child and it never went away. And the reason I tell you about my grandparents and our living situation is, while she did have people to watch me, it was never for a week. And she didn't have family who was supporting her because her family had been torn apart over the murder and her parents weren't around anymore. Just not a lot of family support for my mother. So she puts me on this bus to go see my grandparents. And I did get off at the Bon Marché. The bus driver made sure of that. And I stood there for a while, you know, and it's a downtown city, giant, tall buildings. I don't ever remember being in a downtown before that, you know, all this traffic and noise. So I sat and I didn't see my grandfather. He was supposed to be in this red car. He's a big black man in a red car. You'll recognize him. So I sat on my suitcase and cried because I didn't know what to do. And she had given me their phone number. So I went into the flower shop across from the Bon Marché and called the number. And my grandmother answered, "Girl, what are you doing? He's been looking for you for hours. Get out there," you know. And it was so jarring for me, the speech, the pattern, the volume from what I grew up in. It almost made me want to cry more. I said, okay. So I hung up the phone and went back outside and stood next to my suitcase. And my grandfather pulled up not 5 minutes later. He threw open the door. He's like, "Get in the car, girl. I've been looking for you." And I was like, okay. And it was a really rough week. I mean, for me at my grandparents' house. My grandmother was a beautiful woman. She was the black Rosie Riveter for Boeing. Amazing. She's actually mentioned in the African American Museum here. A very strong woman, but she did not like me from the get-go. My grandfather took me under his wing and he was sort of my protector and said, you know, I did a lot of things I wasn't proud of when I was younger. I can't remember how many children he fathered outside of their marriage. My grandmother and my grandfather had 2 kids together, my dad, Kenny, and his brother, TJ. But there's at least 4 other kids outside the marriage. And he said, you know, when your dad cheated on your mom, my grandma thought she should have stayed with your dad like she did with me. And so you're just getting the leftovers. That's first what he said to me of why she didn't like me. And when I was a teenager, he told me it was because she had a really bad incident with racism in Oklahoma where she was from. And she almost died because she was denied entrance during a snowstorm at a restaurant when she was waiting for a bus actually to come to Seattle as a teenager. What I found interesting about that story is I said, well, why didn't she die? And she said, well, a police officer let her sit in the car with her because the restaurant didn't allow blacks. And the police officer was white. So I never quite understood how that story meant that my grandmother's racism against me, because I was so light skinned, made it okay. But that first week was really hard. The food was different. The language was different. My stomach was upset all the time. I didn't understand what most people were saying to me. It took a lot of adjustment.
Do you remember any specific meals? Like, was it like
I love greens. Collard greens, smothered pork chops, 7-Up cake. I mean, now it's all the foods of my childhood that I remember nostalgically. But that first week, it didn't feel that way. And yeah, and I had a tummy ache. You know, it was very greasy foods, heavy foods. I wasn't ready for any of it. And my grandfather was very nice to me. You know, he said, "You belong here." And I was like, "I don't feel like I belong here." And he said, "You know, us black folks have the one drop rule, where if you have one drop of black blood, we have to accept you because nobody else will. And so don't worry about it. We accept you." But my feeling of that wasn't true, because my grandmother obviously didn't accept me. I mean, she'd take my cousins shopping and wouldn't take me shopping for school clothes, even though we were so poor. My mom and I were definitely much poorer than my uncle and his family. And my aunt too, my uncle TJ's wife, you know, she wasn't the most inviting either. So I had my grandfather. I loved my grandfather. We would sit and talk for hours. A lot of people hated him. He was an asshole, just like my dad. He grew up in a house of ill repute, a prostitution place. Him and his sister, they didn't really know who their mother was. She was a prostitute. And in my grandmother's house, my grandparents' house, when you walked in, there was a picture of my grandfather's father, who looked white. And so they explained my coloring from the fact that I had a European mom. And of course, I took after this great, which is where the Vassar name came from. So eventually I learned to code switch. So I would go over. It means, well, anybody who grows up mixed in two different cultures, you can go into one and you instantly, your language, your body language, everything, your word order switches. And if you would shut your eyes when I was little, I fit right in. You would not have known the color of my skin when I was with my dad's side of the family. And when I was with my mom's side of the family, I fit right in with them as well. My mom helped this along. I've talked about it before. I would come home from spending time with my grandfather. After that 1 week, I would go see them on a semi-regular basis. And when I went to middle school, it was just a few blocks away from their house. We eventually moved into the city. And so I would go there after school and just spend hours with my grandfather hearing stories. But when I was still younger, I came home saying ain't, and my mother made me write, "I will not say ain't 1,000 times." So she definitely helped me get code switching down pretty well.
I've never heard that term.
I think it's a survival mechanism for children, especially children who grow up from two different spaces, either two different cultures. I mean, you're talking about cultural differences.
Missing Pieces will be right back after a break.
So when I was 13, I left middle school and came up to my grandparents' house, and there was my dad. And that's really the first time I remember seeing my dad. He'd gotten clean. My grandmother, as I said before, was from Oklahoma, and they had a house down there. And he went cold turkey twice before I was 13. And this time it stuck, or so we thought a little bit. But there he was in my grandparents' room, living room, painting it, this huge afro, a little bit of a surprise to me. "Hey, baby, how are you?" Like, we had known each other my entire life. The word dad certainly wasn't something that I used. He was a stranger to me. And we saw each other periodically then at my grandparents' house, but we certainly weren't building a relationship. As I said before, he had an older son with his first wife, my brother Kenny, and then my sister Felicia. Then there was me. Then after me came Kenyatta, and then Brian, and then Sarah. So I grew up with these half-siblings. All of us had different moms. Some of the moms were European. Some were black. It's a rainbow family. My mom and dad got back together, actually. They're kind of like magnets that can't help but attract themselves to each other. So I lived in the Soviet Union when I was a senior in high school. I lived in Uzbekistan for a year. But when I got home, my dad had moved in with my mother. I got home and she's sitting on the front porch and she had a cigarette in her hand and she hid it behind herself. When I came home and there's smoke like coming up behind her, like I wouldn't even notice. And inside's my dad. So there was a lot of adjustments to that. I soon left for college within a month. So you know, I wasn't really there when my mom and dad were together, and they were together for about 3 or 4 years and then they broke up again. And it really wasn't until I had children that I developed a relationship with my dad. My mom said to me, "Your kids need a grandparent. They just have me. And my husband's father had also died when he was little. So there wasn't really a grandfather in the picture. So he said, you should give your dad a chance." And I always think my dad came and visited us, at this time because he wanted to see my mom. He loved my mom. He was very much in love with my mom. He kept always trying to get back together with her. And after that period of time, she wouldn't do it. But he did. He was a good grandfather to my kids. He would watch them. He would come visit. And we slowly developed a relationship. And I could use the word dad eventually. Family history has always been important to me. My uncle, TJ, and I had done a lot of research. He did most of it, but I benefited from it and was the one child in the family who was super interested in it. We traced our ancestors back to 3 slave brothers who were sold in Texas. But when you are descendants of slaves, you don't really know what part of Africa they're from. So I said, "Dad, they have these ancestry things. We can find out where in Africa you're from." And there's a horrible history in the Black community with medical testing. And so it's not a thing that people really jump for joy at. Although now the statistics show that Black families buy over-the-counter DNA testing just as much as any other ethnicity. But there's definitely a sense of we don't want to be experimented on and we don't know what they're doing with that information. And that was what my dad said at first. "I don't know about that baby. Like, I don't know what they're going to do with my test results." And I said, "Please, Dad, I really want to know where we're from." And he said, "Sure." So Black Friday came and I bought 2 ancestry tests and I immediately did mine and saved my dad's for Christmas.
You didn't have to have him take the test.
I didn't, but I figured the information was one step closer. It would be more diluted with me. And because of recombination, I might not get as much information.
Did you know what recombination was then?
I did. You did. I'm kind of a nerd. Exactly. I love thinking. I love school, which was unusual. I mean, I was the first person to go to college. I'd pulled myself up by my bootstraps. I had 2 parents who were, you know, drug addicts. I was in special programs most of my life. You know, my mom said it was because of my dad. He was brilliant. I got my test results. I was in bed. It was 2 days before my 44th birthday. And I had a pie chart that was 50%. And I was like, "That's right, I'm half Black. Of course it shows 50%. Which if I knew what recombination was at the time, but I wasn't really thinking clearly. Because if you're African American, you're not half anything. That means you're half African. Not half African American, because Black folks in the U.S. are a hodgepodge of a whole bunch of things over time. My dad's a quarter European because of slavery. So it took me a second. And when I clicked into it, it said I was 50% Ashkenazi. And I had no idea what that was. I had to look it up. And I likened it. I liken that moment when I was like 50% Jewish. And I knew immediately what that meant. I didn't think DNA. Well, in my heart, I knew immediately what it was. It took my brain a few minutes to catch up. But I liken that moment when my son was 4, we lost him in an amusement park. And I remember explaining to the security officer that someone had taken my child because he was not there. He was there a minute ago and then he was gone. And just talking to the security officer who wasn't listening to me, and my world fell apart in that moment. And I zoomed out like they do in the movies, spinning, and I like where you see the globe spinning away from Earth. And that is what I felt like in that moment when I realized that I had zero, I have zero African DNA. My husband has like 1%. I have zero. When I realized in that moment that I wasn't who I thought I was. I told my husband to take the kids outside. We were living in very cramped quarters. And I called a friend of mine who had helped map the human genome and said, "What does this mean? Maybe they mixed up my test." Because that's the first thing you think. It's got to be a mistake. They mixed my test up with somebody else's. And she said, "Open your results and see if you match with anybody." I was like, "Match?" You know, like ancestry was a new thing to me. And I did. I recognized my mom's family names on my matches. And I said, "Maybe they mix up half my test." And she laughed and said, "That's not possible." And I said, "What do I do? I've been duped and I've been lying to everybody about who I am my entire life. My entire life is a lie. And how can I face people? Because I had to prove myself. You're not half black. TJ Vassar couldn't possibly be your uncle. I used to keep a picture of my dad in my pocket. See, I have a picture of him. Must be true. How do I face that? How do I face the world after this?" And she's a very African-American looking woman. And she said to me, "Look, I identify as Latina. I have zero Latinx DNA in me, but that is the culture I identify with. That's what I grew up around. That's the foods I cook. That's the language I speak at home. I am Latina. You can be whoever you want to be." And that was probably the best advice that I got in that moment that I could have gotten from somebody. You can be who you want to be. I had no inkling. My dad had no inkling. And if you would have said, "Did you read the warning? There's a little warning." I would have, it wasn't me. That wasn't me. My dad was my dad. Now, I do remember, and I've talked about this before, looking at the picture of my mom and dad when I was in elementary school, going, if I squint and pretend like I'm colorblind, maybe I look like my dad. But that thought never combined with another thought. I believed the truth that my mom told me, that was my dad. That was my reality. I still feel guilty. I'm finally 5 years later now. I'm very comfortable in my skin and who I am. But it's taken all this time to get to that space. And, you know, the worst thing when I came out, and I think it's a lot like coming out when you decide to go public about your discovery, people were like, "I knew you weren't half black." And it was just devastating. It was the worst thing for somebody to say to me. But on the flip side of that, I went to some PTA event, and my whole life I got the question, "Where are you from?" And this is, people say, "Well, you don't look half black," but my whole life I got this, strangers on the street, "Where are you from? You can't be American, right? You look ethnic." And even after my discovery, I was still getting that question, "Where are you from?" Guess. It was my favorite game. Guess. Guess my background. Once somebody said half black when I was younger, but most of the time it was Greek or Italian or Hispanic. So on one hand, I'm not mixed, at least in the traditional sense of that word, being half black and half white, which are terms I really don't like. There's no black and white. People are of African descent. They're of European descent, Asian descent, Hispanic descent. We're not black and white. And I think those words in and of themselves create opposing tension that doesn't need to be there. But here I am, you know, not mixed, but still being treated sometimes as a person of color. But I remember my cousin telling me, one of my Black cousins, you don't know what it's like to be Black because you haven't experienced what I have. You haven't had to control your words or what you do because of the color of your skin. And I haven't had her experiences, but I've had mine. I've been spat on. I've been slapped. I've been called horrible things. I've been treated as other by everybody in my life, strangers and family members, for most of my life. So when I got my results and finally realized that, figured out dad couldn't be my dad, of course I wanted to know who he was. And I asked my mother. And again, credit to my mom. She said, well, if that's what the DNA says, it's DNA doesn't lie, but I have no idea. I don't know anybody Jewish. It took a year to fully get the story out of her. She had so much shame. She still has shame. I've forgiven her, but I don't think she's forgiven herself. My dad, as I said, was a complete asshole. And she's like, well, I saddled you with this horrible man that I didn't have to saddle you with. As I was processing and going through this, my dad was diagnosed with terminal COPD. And I was caring for him. My grandmother had passed away and it split her family apart over the will. People do crazy things over silly things, over money. People do crazy things over money. There wasn't a lot of money, but the family was split. By then, my Uncle TJ had died of pancreatic cancer, and the family was arguing over my grandmother's will. And I was helping my dad. As I said, I'm a non-practicing attorney. I have a master's degree in tax law, which means estate law, because that's really what people argue over when they argue over stuff like that. So I was helping my dad, and we were getting closer and closer. And telling him was one of the more difficult conversations I've had. I went over there because I have the worst poker face. I knew I couldn't lie. I mean, I had already spent one time with him, and I was like, oh, I can't sing and I wanted to say like you, because you can't sing, but it choked in my throat. I could not say it because it wasn't true anymore. And I knew I couldn't hold that secret in. So I went to tell him. I said to my husband, I just have to go tell him. I just have to do it. And I went over there and I said, Dad, there's something I have to tell you. I was like, you know, I don't know what to say. And I was hemming and hawing. And finally he was like, whatever it is, we'll deal with it. It's okay. And I was like, I just burst into tears. I said, I got my DNA results back before you and you're not my dad. And he was like, oh, that's it. Baby, you're still my daughter. You're still mine. That doesn't matter. And that was that. And he was my biggest supporter until he passed away, in processing, in talking about these things. And without him, I don't know how I would have made it through the first year of my discovery. Because my mom retreated. It had always been us, but this discovery, she retreated. It was just too much for her. So she told me, she said, well, there was this man. I was lonely. Your dad had left with that woman. He was running with her. I was lonely. So I was drinking. I was only 19. Nobody would serve me alcohol. I was drinking in this place on Aurora. Aurora is a very seedy part of Seattle. That's where all the prostitutes are. And I met a man there and, you know, we had an encounter, but I didn't think a baby resulted. And like I said, your dad came back to get his stuff a month later. And I thought that's when you were made. And for, let's see, 4 months, I had no idea who my father was. I had like 13,000 cousins on Ancestry because of endogamy. And no, I had no idea what that meant. I had no idea what being Jewish meant. I was confused. I cried a lot. I didn't look at myself in the mirror because that face I had seen my entire life wasn't mine anymore. I didn't know where it came from. It was a stranger. I avoided the bathroom and the mirror as much as possible. Yeah. So I did get a match eventually. I tried to build trees. I tried to figure out who I was. I needed to know who I was. I have so much empathy for people who haven't identified their parents, their genetic parents, because I felt like I was living in purgatory. I needed an end. I needed answers. And so eventually I got a match. His name was Scott. He was a second cousin or a first cousin once removed. I reached out to him that night and said, oh my gosh, on Ancestry. And he didn't respond. So I started building him a tree. I built it wrong. But I reached out to one of his relatives and my relatives, a distant one. And she was like, oh my gosh, Scott, I can't believe you're related to him. I've been wanting to reach out to him. Let me reach out to him. Maybe I can get him to talk to you. I was like, okay. And she did. And he said, no, I'm not going to talk to her. Talk to my dad, Doug. And he can tell her, he can help her. And here's his email. So I emailed Doug and Doug responded very lovely, actually, the kind of response that anybody in our shoes wishes they had. He told me about his parents, his grandparents. I built him a tree. He was sure I was related to him. And I spent quite a while tracing down all the possible male people in his tree. Now I'm not sure he ever thought I was really related to him. I don't know. Because if you look at a picture of me and my family, my genetic family, I look like them. He did not want me to be related to his wife, Shelley. Shelley's mother is Rose and her father was J. Jacobs. I don't know if you've heard of the J. Jacobs stores. They were a competitor for Nordstrom's across the country in the 80s. Another store like The Bond that didn't make it, but they were huge. I remember shopping there when I was in middle school, actually, or wanting to shop there. I couldn't buy anything, but I remember going in there as a kid. And I think he just really, again, money does weird things to people. And I think he just really did not want me to be related to that side of the family. And as soon as it was clear that I wasn't related to his side of the family, he stopped communicating with me. After exhausting all male possibilities on Doug's side of the family, I switched to Shelley's side of the family. And as soon as I found Shelley's mom, Rose, and Jay Jacobs, I built trees for them, which I had done incorrectly when I first had Scott as a match. I didn't put his mother's tree correctly, which is why I didn't notice it until after I went back to revisit it, because there was nobody possible in Doug's family. And I realized I had made a mistake in his mom's, in Shelley's side of the family. And when I saw that Rose's family, I knew I was related to them. I looked just like them. And there was only one male I thought that was possible. He's about 6 years older than my mother. And I reached out to him snail mail to say, I think you might be my dad. And he called me the day before Father's Day in 2018. You know, and you get that phone call and your heart is pounding. I mean, I swear I thought he could hear it in the phone. And he said, I got your letter. It was such a sweet letter. But, and I had said in the letter, I think you might be my dad. So it wasn't like I mean, it took me a while to get there in the letter, but I said it. And he said, I know you're trying to find your family. And I was thinking, find my family? Like, what are you talking about? He said, I'm dying. I'm losing my memory. I can't really help you. But if you reach out to this person, she can help you. And I said, well, who's this person? He's like, I don't remember. And I said, well, can I call you back if it doesn't work out with them? And at that point, a woman came on the phone and said no. And it was his wife who had been listening in. And they started arguing. And they held the phone back and I couldn't hear what they were saying. And he came back. He said, she said, yes, you can call one more time if you want. So I spent the summer trying to chase down this person, or a month trying to chase down this person. Turns out she was in Europe. And I called the person I thought was my father in July. And he said, I can't help you. I said, can I have some medical information at least, since you've said you're super sick? Nope, that's personal and private. If you would have called a year ago, I would have welcomed you, but I can't do this. And I never talked to him again. When I traced down this person, I met her. She lives in the Seattle area, and I met her and on the front lawn, and she started crying, which is always, you know, I always say, why doesn't the family embrace you? Because you are bringing something home to them that if somebody's deceased, they haven't seen for a while. And she's like, oh my gosh, you look like Sam. And I was like, yeah, he's my grandfather. She's like, no, I don't think so. I think he's your father. You have his eyes exactly. And of course, then I started crying too, because finally I looked like somebody. And she said, I'll do a DNA test for you. I'll show you Sam's your father. So she was actually, she's born in Israel. I guess I should back up a little bit. Once I identified Rose and Jay Jacobs, I thought, oh my gosh, I probably should have looked up Scott before I reached out to him. So that's a tip I say to everybody. Go ahead and do a little internet stalking on whoever you're going to reach out for. Because once I looked up Scott and Doug, I realized they were actually a pretty prominent, pretty wealthy family. And I might have taken a different approach to them. But that was the furthest thing from my mind. I wanted to know who I was.
Yeah, full speed ahead is what
right,
I say.
Full speed ahead. That's what I wanted to know who I was. That's all I wanted to know. Like, who do I look like? Why am I like I am? What makes me tick? But I went back to my mom and I said, Mom, how did you meet this man in a seedy bar on Aurora? I mean, I suppose it's possible, but it just doesn't make sense with this family. And she said, oh, I'm in a bar and a restaurant on Aurora. I was like, oh, what restaurant, Mom? Would have been helpful to have more of this information sooner. And again, you know, this is like pulling teeth from somebody. It's very hard to get at this point from my mother facts from my mom. And she's like, oh, that was the Cannulus. And I was like, oh, now that makes sense. The Cannulus is the most, the Cannulus restaurant. It is the most expensive restaurant in Seattle. I mean, if I was to go there now, it'd be $500 for my husband and I'd have dinner there. And it's always been one of the nicest restaurants in Seattle. So when I went and saw this person and she said, oh, you look just like Sam. I was talking to her. She brought me in her house. She fed me. She showed me family photos. Sam had paid for her wedding, brought her from Israel, paid for her to go to college. And I said, where did Sam go to eat? Oh, he ate at the Cannulus once a week. And that's when I knew, yeah, she's probably right. He's probably my dad, because I could never place her son in April and May. I mean, his son, Sam's son, in April and May, which is when I was conceived, in Seattle. He had moved down to California. So the test came back and I triangulated everything, had a genetic genealogist do it. And Sam is definitely my father. He was a very prominent philanthropist in Seattle and businessman. So yeah, I got my smarts from my dad. He graduated from college at like 19. Built a business into a huge multinational business. He canned salmon. He had a salmon company. You can still buy Rubenstein salmon. Fidalgo Foods bought the label. And then I had my answers. But the family did not want contact with me. And once my family I grew up with, my cousins, found out that I wasn't related to them by blood, they didn't want contact with me. When my older brother, Kenny, found out I wasn't related to him, he wanted my dad to stop having interactions with me. Told him he had to choose between us. Lots of rejection. people always hear about being rejected by your genetic family when you reach out. But people sometimes are rejected by the family they grew up with too.
Do you think it was because of racism?
I think it's because they were asked to accept me because I was Kenny's daughter and they really didn't want to in the first place. And now they didn't have to. You know, you asked me about photos and I spent the weekend looking for photos for you.
Sorry.
And I had never realized I have no photos of me and my cousins when I was younger. Not one photo. It's like it didn't happen. I asked my mom about it and she said, well, I dropped you off. They would have had to take those photos. They would have had to share those photos. And they didn't because they really just didn't want me there. And that's hard to contemplate. It was a harsh realization this weekend. Like, wow, it's almost like it didn't happen. I have pictures of my kids with their kids because I tried for years to build, to keep that relationship going.
And so with Sam, did Sam have, do you have siblings on Sam's side?
Sam had my brother. They had tried to have other children, but his wife Gladys was Rh negative. And so she had about 10 miscarriages. And for me, I did go and read about him in the newspaper. He's been mentioned more than 500 times. And I had some weird, I've had some things to deal with, like, okay, I didn't make it. I'm not, I didn't pull myself up by my bootstraps like I thought. I've talked about this with a couple other people who've been in similar points where you find out your parent is so much more successful than the one who raised you. It calls into question your own standing within your family and your own successes. I was able to get pictures from the opera and the symphony, which he funded significantly because he was at events and there was public pictures available. And one of the newspaper articles that I just is such a craziness to me is that time period when we're in the food bank line. My father was on his yacht hosting 200 people for lunch. It's such a huge discrepancy between the life that I had and the life that maybe I could have had. But because his wife was Rh negative, they had a significant number of miscarriages. And I was told that she wanted to adopt. And Sam said, no, only blood children. And I think if they would have found out about me, my mom was so poor and they had so much. I think that if they had found out about me when I was born, they would have taken me from my mother. Things work out for a reason. And I have to tell myself that. One of the things I've done for my healing process, one of my therapist said to make a family book, to go to the places where he was in Seattle and take pictures of me there. And so I was tracing where he grew up near the University of Washington. His parents had a home. His home has been torn down that was on Lake Washington, but I went to the University of Washington and there's all these pictures and plans of it because it was a famous architect who built it. And then his condo was on Queen Anne Hill next to this park called Cary Park. It's a famous park. Most of the pictures you've seen of Seattle are this view from Cary Park. And when I was 16, I moved out of the house for a year with my boyfriend who was independently wealthy. And so he was like, just choose an apartment somewhere in the city. And I lived for a year across the street from my dad, which I'm like, did we run into each other?
That's crazy. Well, the same thing happened to me. I was like in the year 2000, this friend of mine was like, hey, can you come to Club Med with me? I need a wingman. And I was like, yeah, I guess. And so I went to Club Med with him in Mexico. And when I found out I had this biological father, one of the sisters still lives in Mexico. And I was like, where is it? And she kind of told me, and I looked on a map, and I God, that's got to be near Club Med. But I didn't say anything to her. And I Googled Club Med Mexico, and nothing came up about it in her town. I'm like, what the fuck? I'm like, I guess I was wrong. Like, I'm just remembering where it was differently. So anyway, cut to my wife and I go down there to shoot a promo for the town that they live in, because she's a realtor down there. And we're scouting locations, and we go by this locked, we had to go turn around on this cul-de-sac kind of, and there was this lock gate, and I love abandoned stuff. And I was like, what's behind there? And they were like, oh, it's an old Club Med. I don't know what they're doing with it now. So I didn't think anything. And then we go out onto the beach, like this peninsula. And now you can see the Club Med. And I just stopped in my tracks. And I'm like, they're like, what? And I'm like, I've been here. Like, and so I was there in that town where he lived when he was alive, in the a small town in Mexico. Like, what are the fucking odds? Like, same odds of you living across the street.
It's crazy. So I have to tell you, I hated the movie The Jerk growing up. Like, I thought it was the stupidest thing ever. How could Steve Martin think he was a black man? Oh, but now I look at that and I'm like, oh my God, it's hysterical. Like, if we can't laugh at ourselves, what else are we going to do, right? And I
must have had a whole new meaning for you, that movie.
It does. It did. I think it's funny. I see that movie in a totally different way. I'm the real jerk, the real life jerk. And I can joke about it with myself, but,
did you invent the grabbeth? What is that called?
And slowly over time, I've tried to build my Jewish experiences. So now I feel comfortable with my Jewish skin. I feel comfortable with my mixed skin. I feel comfortable with both those things. And I can be both of those things at the same time. And that's okay. It doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. The question of who's a Jew is the most complicated question I have ever come across in my entire life. I love studying. I love being in my head. And it is crazy. I had no idea until my discovery. Even my rabbi, who's female, said, you know, because I went to Israel a year ago. And she said to me, when you go, don't tell anybody your story. People don't even think I'm Jewish, because she's Jewish by patrilineal descent, and she's a female rabbi. And some Jews wouldn't even think of her as Jewish. And I don't want you to feel like you're being left out by, so don't tell people your story. And I thought about it and I was like, nope, I've been surrounded by lies and secrets and untruths my entire life. And I'm living in the truth. And I told my story and I was totally accepted everywhere. People spoke Hebrew to me on the street because they thought I looked like I belonged there. And it was the first time I was like, I didn't feel like I came home. People asked me about that, but I felt like I found my place, in the sense that there is a place where if you put me there, I would blend right in. And I have never had that. I've always been, you know, that Sesame Street song, which one of these things is not like the other? My entire life, I was the one that stuck out. And in Israel, I didn't anymore. And that was probably the most healing thing for me in my journey.
So I think that's a good place to stop. So now it's like at the end of the Scooby-Doo episode, we're going to rip the mask off. Her name is Kara Rubenstein Darin. And she's, along with some other folks, started Right to Know.
I started Right to Know with Alicia, who also had an NPE, David, who's a late discovery adoptee, and Gregory, who's a donor-conceived person. And I was asked to do an interview in Seattle on DNA surprises. And I wanted to bring other people along for that interview so people understood it's not just, it's a huge issue. We're a huge population. I actually think we make up 5% of the population. 5% of the population probably has misattributed parentage. And it's not just from a one-night stand like me, or an extramarital affair, or an assault, or some sexual encounter where paternity is hidden. It's also from adoption, either informal or formal, as well as from assisted reproduction. And I wanted to highlight all those things. And afterwards, we were sitting around having dinner, and I wanted to change my birth certificate. And I'm having a hard time in Washington State. It's different in each state. You have to go to court and name somebody. It's a paternity suit. Well, my father's dead. All of his executors are dead. His son is dead. There's nobody for me to name. I could probably do it if I could have somebody to take to court. And I thought that where are my rights in all of this? Where are my genetic identity rights? I want to know my family medical history. And understand, knowing family medical history, my children don't have a right to know their family medical history. If I stop talking to them tomorrow, they have no right to that. And things need to change about that on a much higher level. So when we're sitting around having dinner, we decided we needed a nonprofit that could advocate for our genetic identity rights, that could provide mental health support, because there didn't really seem to be much out there. I felt very much alone. And that could provide education to the public as well as people making these discoveries. So they know what recombination is. They know how to look at their matches. They know what imposter syndrome is, or ambiguous loss, or ghost kingdom. All these things that you slowly build up a vocabulary for after you have these discoveries. And hopefully we can educate people. We won't get those, "You're still you, and it doesn't matter," things from the public, so they can understand where we're coming from. So we created Right to Know, and we have a mental health branch where we do mentorships and online support groups and Facebook support groups. And then we have a directory of therapists who have experience helping people with these sorts of discoveries, because we all have heard this person who goes to their therapist and the therapist is like, "Oh my gosh, what happened to you? I can't believe it." And they just don't understand the horizontal and vertical ramifications of such a discovery. And they're sort of flippant about it. And then we do education. We have webinars. We have an education site where we actually offer continuing education classes for therapists for credit so they can do a better job. And we have now our second Untangling Our Roots Summit, where we can come together to learn and have community and heal together. And then we do advocacy work. We've passed fertility fraud related to assisted reproduction to have a consequence, both civil and criminally, for lying in assisted reproduction. We've passed bills like that in Nevada and Iowa. We have a federal bill proposed. We have bills in New York and Washington. And I'm now working on the issue that's very dear to me, which is birth certificate reform. So we can have both our raising family and our genetic parents on our birth certificate, and we can change that, and it never goes away. So my great-great-grandkids, when they get that silly school assignment, they can know that they're related to Kalena Rubenstein and Sam Rubenstein, and that Kenny Vassar, and the Vassars are also part of that mix as well.
Thank you, Cara, for coming on today, and thank you for starting Right to Know. To check out Right to Know, go to righttoknow.us. There are a ton of resources on there for all of us. And don't forget to go to untanglingourroots.org to register. And it's coming up April 25th through 28th, 2024 in Denver. All the music today is from Pixabay, which is this website that offers free music. You can download it, use it for whatever you want. Please don't forget to leave a review. I love hearing from you guys. And rate the podcast. This is Don Anderson, and I'm the host of Missing Pieces in PE Life. And I'll see you on the next episode.